Amongst the casualties of the Christchurch earthquakes was the Trinity Pacific Presbyterian Church in inner city Christchurch, which was so badly damaged that it had to be demolished. My regret about the departure of this church was that it hinders the possibility of making what I think would be one of the most fascinating docudrama projects for our homegrown film industry, a reenactment of the Gehring heresy trial. For it was here in 1967 that the Presbyterian General Assembly heard charges of false doctrine against the then head of its Knox Ministry Training School. He was specifically charged with denying the immortality of the soul and that Christ rose from the dead on the third day, which you might think, as I do, is about the most central doctrine of the Christian faith. The case aroused widespread media interest, and the withdrawal of the charges against him aroused passionate feelings on both sides of the argument. It was a watershed moment in the history of the Christian faith in New Zealand, with considerable consequences. There are some people who can talk their way out of just about any situation, and Lloyd Gehring must have done some pretty good talking to have dodged a bullet on this occasion. Maybe he'd learned a thing or two from this morning's gospel passage, with its very clever and quick-witted reply to a trick question. Religious leaders whose ministry brings them into the public eye need some essential survival skills to deal with potentially unfriendly audiences, such as journalists with an axe to grind. In that respect, they have much to learn from politicians who have to deal with hostile gambits disguised as polite inquiries all the time. A common tactic is the loaded question to which there are no win answers, if you take the question just as it stands. The greatest past master at dodging this kind of ambush was David Longy, who would reply, "What you're really trying to ask me is, and then you're going to ask me, and finally you'll end up by asking me this." Each of which self-generated questions, he would give a series of answers that carried the debate to a very different place. In a way, David Longy had not dodged the issue, because usually his quick intelligence had seen the meta-issue behind the question and had travelled to the final end point of this line of inquiry long before his audience. If he had repositioned the thorny and difficult matter under discussion to his advantage, then that was his good fortune. This is the approach Jesus used in this morning's contestation story with the religious elite, who were out to trip him up. As usual, the question put to him masks much bigger issues. His clever answer engages with both of them at a deep and ultimate level. How are Christians to make their way through a world in which power is an ambivalent and often unavoidable reality, and in which compromises sometimes have to be made between the ideal and the difficult practical realities? Here Jesus asserts God's rights, his legitimate claims on his followers, over their conduct in the world he made. The Pharisees and the Herodians might have been expected to start from the perspective of what does God expect of us in this situation, but surprisingly, they hadn't. Their question assumes a ground-up approach in which the hated Roman occupation, with its heavy personal tax burden — remember, Palestine was a very difficult province — fills the vision of those thinking about it in such a way that all their choices are dominated by this limited perspective. If they'd cared to dig deep in their scriptures, they would have found a rich resource for thinking through how God makes his purposes prevail in a world of ruthless power politics and tyrannical militaristic empires. The Jewish people had come being conquered and humiliated by the cruelest people the world had ever known, the Assyrians and then the Babylonians. But these ruthless and highly militarized societies had got their comeuppance from the Persian Empire that appeared out of nowhere, and having got the upper hand, proceeded to free the Jewish exiles and allow them to return home to reconstitute the Jewish nation. So in this morning's first lesson, God calls Cyrus, Emperor of Persia, my anointed, whom I have taken by his right hand. I have called you by your name, conferring a title, though you do not know me. Though you do not know me, I arm you. Even the greatest powers become the unwitting pawns of God in his providential plans and unstoppable purposes. The adversaries of Jesus might have also cared to take a look at the book Daniel, whose apocalyptic storyline combines what Edward Oakes calls a fusion of extreme tribulation with irrepressible hope. Trying to make sense of the terrible times the Jewish people had passed through under the Greek generals who had been in charge just a generation or two before Jesus, the book Daniel concludes that sometimes God allows evil to run its course, so that when it becomes full-blown and fully developed, God can cut that canker out of the human story. Before I leave this theme, I recall how many of those who took part in the bomb plot against Hitler were practicing Christians. It seems that their faith had insulated them against the siren call of National Socialism, with its extreme nationalism, racism, nihilism, and pagan love of violence. Our faith ought to give us the sensibility and insight to see through all the false promises of political manipulators. Today's trick question raises the second and even more interesting issue of why the religious elite disliked Jesus so much and had so much energy around getting rid of him. I accept Jane Williams' thesis that he knew God better than they did, and that they knew he did know God better than them, and that this cut them to the quick, because they were the holiness party in the Jewish religion of their day, who claimed to have the inside running on who God was and what he wanted from his people. Jesus had called them out, had trumped them, on the one thing that they really cared about. This made the conflict between them inevitable, because with his superiority in debate, he had left them nowhere to go but to either follow him or eliminate him. Which brings us back to the Gehring heresy trial and the abundant religious contestation that goes on in the church of our day. How do we decide where to place ourselves in this contest for the soul of our church? The answer is that it seems to me is that with the group or the individuals who know God best. Which of the contending parties looks at the issues from the perspective of what does God want in this situation? Which of the persuasive voices appears to have situated themselves in a genuine attempt at holiness that takes seriously the call of the New Testament for the Christian church to be a distinct and set apart people, a counter society to the prevailing norms around us? Which of the groups seems to be able to engage with the issues at some theological depth while avoiding clichés, slogans, and empty phrases? There is a hollowed out version of the Christian faith that has infiltrated its way into the church with its moral relativism and theological confusion that thinks it can say the creed with its fingers crossed. We need to be able to penetrate the clever talk that masks this agenda and have a genuine discernment of spirits that unmasks the false faith. We need to be able to locate the section of opinion that is genuinely contending for the truth and then line up behind it so as to be identified with that part of the church that will live.